Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. There's a lot of opposition to the last 12 verses of the Gospel according to Mark, even from Christians. And if those verses were not original, then Mark has the worst ending in the history of endings. Before anyone had seen the resurrected Christ, when the women, quote, "The women went out quickly and fled from the tomb, for they trembled and were amazed, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid." Now, when Peter Jackson gave 8 endings to The Lord of the Rings, and some have been sorely criticized, ending Mark at verse 8 instead of verse 20 makes for the worst ending in the history of endings. Many, including Reformed theologians like Pastor John MacArthur, Matt Slick, who debated at our Denver Bible Church, and James White, whom I debated at Denver's Brown Palace, these and many others claim the last 12 verses of Mark, as they most certainly appear in your Bible, in my Bible, right here in the studio, that they claim they're not really part of the original gospel. What an honor to speak today with the author of Authentic, The Case for Mark 16, 9 through 20. Welcome, James Snapp, to Real Science Radio.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to be talking with you. We'll get to the two well-known manuscripts from the 300s that lack those last 12 verses. But if we begin, James, with the earliest known reference from Irenaeus. He was a very influential bishop in France. He wrote about Mark. What year would you say his reference is from?
Well, Irenaeus, in the composition Against Heresies, it was issued in several books. In one of those books, he mentions the timing of who is in charge of the church at Rome at the time. And so by tracing that statement, we can estimate that his statement about Mark 16:19 was made around the year 180 or so.
Around the year 180. And so could you tell us, what did Irenaeus say about the ending of Mark?
He's kind of looking through the Gospels and summarizing each one's gist. He mentions in the Gospel of Mark the contents of Mark 16:19. It's quoted very specifically. He says, Mark, toward the end of his Gospel, says that after the Lord had spoken to them, he was received up into heaven and set down at the right hand of God.
Wow. So I have in front of me the New King James Version translation of Mark 16, verse 19, and then from Irenaeus, like you just quoted, and they appear to be about identical. And if, in fact, the original Gospel of Mark did not have the last 12 verses, it had a short chapter, so to speak, well, then how could he be quoting this as from the end of Mark? Here's what my New King James says. Mark 16, verse 19. So then, after the Lord had spoken to them, he was received up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God. Here's what Irenaeus wrote back in 180 AD, and this is less than a century after John the Apostle passed away. He wrote, at the end of the gospel, Mark says, and so the Lord Jesus, after he had spoken to them, was received into the heavens and sits at the right hand of God. There is no question that he is quoting chapter 16, verse 19.
Clearly, in Irenaeus' text of the Gospel of Mark, Mark 16, 19 was included. John MacArthur, by the way, I'm aware of his 2006 or so sermon on the fitting end of the Gospel of Mark. He makes all kinds of mistakes, large mistakes, in the course of that sermon. I've encouraged Grace to you to retract the sermon and try again. So far, no result. Mm. But if you look online on YouTube, I just recently put another critique pointing out about 10 of his worst mistakes. There are many, many more. And inviting grace to you to retract the false claims. It's not a matter of, no, this doctrine is controversial. It's simply a matter of him getting his facts mixed up.
Yes. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, you wrote an article on this. So that's 180 AD, thereabouts. And again, we'll get to these two manuscripts, Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, from the 300s. But let me ask you this first, a couple other questions first. If you total all of the Greek manuscripts of, or that include the Gospel of Mark specifically, how many are there back before there was a printing press of the handwritten Mark manuscripts? How many are we talking about?
Of those that have survived to the present day, somewhere in the region of 1,650.
1,650 manuscripts of the New Testament that contain the Gospel of Mark. That's an extraordinary number. What percentage of them include the full chapter of Mark, not the short chapter? What percentage of those 1,650 handwritten manuscripts that still exist include the full chapter of Mark? About?
Yes. Folks sometimes get misinformed. For instance, in the message, the footnote says that only later manuscripts have Mark 16:9-20, and that's simply false. They should correct that footnote as soon as possible.
That's in the Message Bible, which is very popular.
The Message paraphrase. I don't really call it a Bible.
Yeah, it's still, good point.
That's a whole other topic. This footnote at this point, it's been on the market for years and years and years, and they still haven't fixed it. It's hard to think that that is entirely accidental.
So what percentage then of all those will include the full chapter?
There are only two that end the Gospel of Mark at chapter 16, verse 8. There's one non-continuous copy called Manuscript 304, which contains the text of Mark, but it's a commentary manuscript where you have a little bit of Mark, then commentary, then a little bit of Mark, a little bit of commentary. So strictly speaking, it's not a continuous text manuscript, but it's on the map.
So of those,
a total of three.
So three.
It's usually described in vague terms as some say this and some say and others say that. But what the real situation is, three versus 1,650.
Now, we're just talking about the Greek manuscripts.
Yes.
Because, of course, the New Testament was written in Greek. But as our interview continues, we'll talk about the numbers of manuscripts in Latin and in other languages. Regarding Jerome's Latin Vulgate, now he's the early church's leading Bible translator. Two things about him, one by James White and the other by John MacArthur. In James White's helpful anti-King James only book, he writes about the ending of Mark and he brings up Jerome. And John MacArthur put out a video, which obviously you know about, and he's speaking against the ending of Mark. And shockingly, he references as part of his argument that there are 8,000 copies of Jerome's Latin Vulgate in history. But there's some misrepresentation there by John MacArthur. Could you explain what Jerome actually did with the ending of the Gospel of Mark?
There are three things that he did. The first thing that should be noted is that Jerome included Mark 16:9-20 in his text of the Vulgate. The Vulgate was the translation into Latin that he was commissioned to make by Pope Damasus.
So when John MacArthur is referencing Jerome, this incredible scholar, as part of his argument that these verses should not be part of Mark 16, he doesn't tell his church members that Jerome himself included the full chapter in his Latin Vulgate. He doesn't tell them that.
Yes, it's kind of amazing for those that know better to listen to John MacArthur cite the Latin Vulgate and say all the Latin copies say the same thing, while he's simultaneously making a case against the reading that all the Vulgate copies contain.
Wow.
It's kind of surreal when you know the background of what MacArthur was saying.
So you said there are three things. That's the first thing?
The first thing is that he included Mark 16:9-20 in the text of the Latin Vulgate, which he says when he prefaces the Vulgate, in its preface, he says that he revised the Latin text using as his standard the ancient Greek copies that he had. He says only the ancient Greek copies were relied upon. So that's one thing to note, that copies that Jerome considered ancient in the year 383, that was the basis for the Vulgate.
Wow.
So right there, you have a copy that Jerome, probably born around 340 or so, he probably wouldn't call a manuscript ancient if he was older than the manuscript was.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, when Jerome writes about the ending of Mark, he points out, and this is what James White does, he says that Jerome was aware that many of the Greek manuscripts were missing this ending of Mark, but then Jerome wrote this. He's bringing up the idea of the two different endings of Mark. We could call it the short chapter and the full chapter of Mark 16. And here's Jerome, quote, "Of which question the solution is twofold. For either we do not receive the testimony of Mark, which is extant in rare gospels, almost all of the Greek books not having this chapter at the end." So right there, let me ask you, James Snap Jr., the author of Authentic, The Case for Mark 16, 9 through 20. I notice a couple things right there. Jerome is not saying that there are no Greek manuscripts that have the full chapter. He's certainly not saying that.
Yes, I think Norman Geisler tried to perpetuate the claim that Jerome says they weren't there in his copies at all. But that's not the case. More importantly, the second thing that I was going to mention, that Jerome, when he says these things, he's echoing the works of Eusebius of Caesarea, who lived about 100 years earlier. Eusebius of Caesarea's words have been snippeted a lot. And when you look at just the snippets, the impression is that Eusebius was rejecting the passage. But when you look at his fuller text, a man named Roger Pierce has taken the time to collect and translate the ancient records of this composition that Eusebius wrote. And you can find it for free. Just download Eusebius of Caesarea, Gospel Problems and Solutions. And if you compare side by side, this was a point made by Bergen more than 100 years ago. If you look at some of Eusebius' questions that he's trying to answer and the questions that Jerome's trying to answer, three of them are the same questions in the same order. So it's not difficult to see that Jerome, as he's writing, is rendering into Latin part of what Eusebius was saying in Greek. In other words, Jerome is not coming up with anything new in this part of his composition by himself. He is simply recycling and condensing things that Eusebius had said before in order to get rid of what would be a rather long and detailed question about the events after Jesus' resurrection. So when Jerome says this, he's simply summing up what Eusebius had said before. But then he proceeds to explain to the person he's writing to, Hedibia, he proceeds to explain how to pronounce the text of Mark 16:9 when it's being read, which is just what Eusebius did with his correspondent, Amerinus, back in the 320s, 330s or so. So the first thing to realize is when Jerome, when he makes this remark, he's simply summarizing what Eusebius had said. Then the second point is that neither Eusebius nor Jerome stop there. And Eusebius proceeds to say to Marinus, who he realizes Marinus already has Mark 16:9-20, or I wouldn't be quoting from it. Eusebius then proceeds to say how to pronounce Mark 16:9, how to enunciate the text.
Yeah.
Which is not what a person does when they're saying
it doesn't exist. Right. When I studied Greek back in Nyack Bible College in New York State back in 1977, 78, and then in Denver at Derby School of Theology for a few years, we spent a lot of time figuring out how to pronounce these words. That's part of what you do when you want to understand the text. You want to read it to one another. You want to pronounce it. So what a great point, Eusebius correcting the pronunciation.
Eusebius at the time is answering questions about what happens after the resurrection. And the idea is that he's writing this to explain what looks like a contradiction isn't really a contradiction.
Yes. Yeah. So,
and by pronouncing Mark 16:9 a certain way, it resolves the apparent contradiction.
Thank you so much for that, James. For me to state it so I could be more confident that I understand the point, Eusebius is talking to someone who has the full chapter of the end of Mark, and they're discussing whether there's a problem when you compare the different resurrection accounts of the Gospels. And Eusebius says, well, look at verse 9, and here's how you pronounce the verse, and there really isn't a problem. You just have to understand it. So that's Eusebius. Then Jerome is summarizing Eusebius, but he includes the entire full chapter in the Latin Vulgate, which is his ultimate testimony about the text.
Yes. The third thing about Jerome is, in the early 400s, around 417 or so, he made a comment about a passage called the Phrygologion. It only exists today in one manuscript. But when he describes that passage or that interpolation, he says he's seen it especially in Greek codices, which indicates what his real view was, independent of Eusebius. He knows he's going to just proceed on to explain Hedivia, how to accept and how to embrace and pronounce Mark 69. But also toward the end of his life in Ad Pelagians, he once again refers to the Phrygologion, but when he locates it, when he tells his readers where he has found it, he refers to the contents of Mark 16:14, expecting them to have that in their text already.
Wow. But how about this? Back to John MacArthur, when he's arguing that these last 12 verses of the Gospel of Mark, that's in all of our Bibles for the most part. They're in all these versions that we have here in the studio. When he's arguing that that's not part of the Bible, he also appeals to the Syriac Bible, and he says there are 350-plus copies of the Syriac Bible in history.
Yes. That's another surreal characteristic of his sermon. There is one important Syriac copy called the Sinaitic Syriac. It's still there at St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai to this day, in which Mark ends at 16, verse 8. There's also the Curetonian Syriac. Again, it's only one manuscript, and it's quite damaged at the end of Mark, but it does have a little bit of Mark 16, verse 17 from that point on. But that's the only part of Mark that the Curetonian Syriac has. Wow. And when it comes to the Peshitta copies go into the hundreds. They include Mark 16, 9 through 20. And so does the Hyrcanian Syriac in the text. So John MacArthur basically has taken one Syriac manuscript and given his listeners the impression that this is representative of the whole Syriac tradition, which is just the opposite of the case.
As Christianity spread, we find manuscripts from different geographic regions.
Yes.
With 99% of Syriac manuscripts containing Mark's full last chapter. How about the Ethiopic manuscripts? Do you have a sense for how many of those are extant?
Hundreds and hundreds, I think, would be the best way to summarize that.
Do you recall what percentage of Ethiopic manuscripts contain Mark's full ending?
100%. And here again, we have an example of how hard it is to get scholars to recognize when a mistake has been made. There are very many Ethiopic copies. They're not really a focus of most textual critics, but some folks do look at them very closely. An especially important one used to be dated to the 1100s, but the closer they looked at it, they realized maybe that's earlier. Could we get some dating on this? Well, one person decided that he would arrange for radiometric tests to be done, and they found out that, well, this part could be as late as the early 600s, but it's pretty close to the 500s. So with one test, that copy, known as the Gerima Gospels, reassigned its date twice as early than it had been assigned to.
On Real Science Radio, we've done a dozen programs on carbon dating. And as you go further and further back in history, you get to Egypt's Middle Kingdom, their Old Kingdom, even their New Kingdom. And Egyptologists do not rely on carbon dating because the further back in history you get, the less reliable it becomes. But we're talking about a period of time that's going to give us the ballpark of when a manuscript was written. So thank you for that information.
So the Gerima Gospels, just like all the other copies of the Gospels in Ethiopic, includes Mark 16, 9 through 20. And in some of the older commentaries and some of the newer commentaries that are simply written by people quoting the older commentaries that they've read, it used to be said that the Ethiopic copies, some of them don't have Mark 16, 9 through 20. But Bruce Metzger, who himself perpetuated that claim earlier in his career, in 1980, he made a special study to double check that claim. And the copies that he thought would end at Mach 16.8 actually continued on to include the whole ending, verses 9 through 20. He and another scholar then proceeded to look at all the copies of Mark in Ethiopic they had access to, and they concluded that everybody, practically in the whole field of textual criticism, had been spreading this claim based on how the copies had been misrepresented back in the 1800s.
Wow.
In 1980, Bruce Metzger basically retracted his old claim, replaced it with the list of the evidence that he had in his support. But that was 1980, and here we are in 2020, and you can still find books by the late Norman Geisler that will tell you, oh, some Ethiopic copies don't have Mark 16, 9 through 20.
I would like to build on that with a quote you bring from a pastor in Texas who's got degrees from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. But first, real quick, when you say that error was introduced in the 1800s, we did a series with Professor Peter Gentry on the documentary hypothesis, the higher critics. Basically, they tore the Pentateuch to pieces, they shredded it, and we went through a classic book written just after World War II by Umberto Casuto called The Documentary Hypothesis, and we saw how the bias was so strong against the scriptures that any argument against them, regardless of how easily it could be corrected, took hold and became fact. So do you think that was part of the history of the times, that such a mistake could be made and then it could be quoted for over a century and no one even check it?
Yeah, I think there's a mechanism. I don't know quite what to call it. But once something has become the consensus view, it's very, very hard to challenge that, even when the evidence completely blows it away. In Bruce Metzger's The Text in the New Testament, edited now, I think, in its fourth edition, edited with Bart Ehrman, you can find the statement that Mark 16, 9 to 20 is not missing in some Ethiopic copies, and you'll find it's missing in some Ethiopic copies on different pages of the same book from the same guy that made the correction back in 1980. That gives you some idea of how entrenched a consensus view can be among scholars, because they never do what Bergen told them to do way back in the 1800s, which was check your references.
Oh, and examples of what you're talking about with the number of human chromosomes, for example, that was originally, I mean, you have scientists looking through a microscope and they didn't have it as 46, they had it as 48. And that error persisted for decades, even though thousands of students in their labs would be told, okay, now count the chromosomes, and they would count 46, but they'd write down 48. And so these kinds of problems, I remember the story of Ignaz Semmelweis, who said, you know, all you got to do is wash your hands and you reduce death in maternity hospitals by 60% or more. And he was right, but doctors would refuse to change their practice. So once an error becomes mainstream, it is very difficult to correct it.
Yes, I think we're talking about the concept of what's called groupthink.
Groupthink, yeah.
Once something is said in a respected journal and that spreads around a while, it becomes the consensus view because nobody challenges the claim. I think to this day, Matt Slick, who you mentioned earlier, is still spreading the claim about the Ethiopic copies here in 2021, even though it was shown to be incorrect by Bruce Metzger in 1980.
Wow. James, in your book, Authentic, you mention a Southwestern pastor, and I would like to share his quote right now because it seems to typify the bias against the reality of the ending of Mark. And this is First Baptist Church pastor Bob McCartney in Wichita Falls, Texas. He has two graduate degrees, not one, but two graduate degrees from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And here's what he writes. It's also a fact that these verses, as I've said a couple of times, really don't have any substantiation until you get to medieval times. Until you get to about 800 or 900 AD, you can't find a manuscript that contains these verses of Scripture. That seems so extreme and so contrary to history.
Yes, the speaker's statement is simply absurd. It's just false. It's bizarrely false. Irenaeus in the 100s in his copy of Mark, the longer ending of Mark, chapter 16, verse 19, is quoted, but also is extensively quoted by Augustine. And every manuscript that we have in Greek, except for Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, include Mark 16, 9 through 20, at least enough to show that when the manuscript was in pristine condition, that it had those 12 verses. You can find Codex Alexandrinus online today and simply turn to that page and you'll see it right there before your eyes. Mm. So it's a case where an author has simply been sloppy and tried to present his minimal knowledge as fact. And that might result in him being believed, but unfortunately what he's actually doing is badly misinforming his audience.
And because we're talking about the Gospels, one of the four evangelists, it's not a minor issue. This is how they say that it ends, that the women who had gone to the tomb, they went out quickly and fled from the tomb, for they trembled and were amazed, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. That has got to be the worst ending in the history of endings, if it were true. But so these arguments, like the one from this pastor from Wichita Falls, Texas, I can understand an intellectual confusion, but they make it with such passion, and they make it against the actual facts of the matter.
Oftentimes, it's not so much a matter of against, but a matter of how much they leave out. Mark Strauss, a professor for Zondervan, recently talked briefly about the ending of Mark, and he said basically what you can see in some Bible footnotes, like in some of the translations that I think he works on. He mentions that the earliest manuscripts don't have these 12 verses, but then he avoids mentioning the testimony of Irenaeus and Justin and Tatian, which are much earlier. Then he also avoids mentioning the scope of verses 9 through 20, from Ireland to Milan, Italy, to North Africa, to the land of Israel. It's all over the place.
Syria.
The only place where we really see it not being there is in the Alexandrian transmission line. Mm.
One more question before we get to the two most famous early manuscripts that don't have the full chapter. The last question I have is about the Latin manuscripts. What percentage of Latin manuscripts contain Mark's full ending?
The Vulgate is overwhelmingly the dominant force in Latin. But even if you threw in all of the old Latin as well, the proportion would still be more than 99.9% include Mark 16, 9 to 20. In fact, apart from manuscripts that have been damaged, I know of only one Latin manuscript of Mark that does not conclude with all 12 verses of Mark 16, 9 to 20.
Wow, that is astounding. So the case we've made so far is you go back as early as 180, and the very influential bishop in France, in Lyon, is quoting from the beginning to the ending of Mark.
Yes. As Irenaeus is reviewing the Gospels, as he reviews Luke, then he reviews Mark, he says in Against Heresies, Book 3, "Wherefore also Mark, the interpreter and follower of Peter, does thus commence his Gospel narrative." So first he gives the beginning of it. "The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in the prophets."
So here, the very beginning from the first verse is being quoted. And then where does he go from there?
Then he refers to Mark 16:19, and he says, "Also, toward the conclusion of his gospel, Mark says, 'So then, after the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was received up into heaven and sits on the right hand of God.'"
Wow. Wow. And that's explicit.
Yes, you can also look at some non-explicit but highly, highly likely other patristic writers from the second century. Justin, in his First Apology, chapter 45, uses a series of words in the same way that they appear in Mark 16:20. So that's not a spelled out, written in large capital letters reference.
Right, right.
But it is a very probable reference where he's just using spontaneously what we know as Mark 16:20. Tatian, a writer who combined Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John into one continuous, non-repeating, mostly non-repeating, narrative called the Diatessaron. And when you look at the Arabic Diatessaron, which comes from the Syriac transmission line of the Diatessaron, and when you look at the Codex Fuldensis, and how the text of Mark 16:9-20 is arranged in both sources. We have both an Eastern source and a Western source confirming that arrangement of Mark 16:9-20. Also, the later writer Ephraim, well, not too much later, he's from the 360s. Ephraim Cyrus, when he's making his commentary on the Diatessaron, he refers to the parts that come from Mark 16:9-20. Plus Aphrahat, since we mentioned Syriac before, yeah. Aphrahat is a writer who's writing before any of the Syriac manuscripts that have survived were made. Aphrahat, writing his first demonstration around the year 337, he quotes from Mark 16:9-20. So those are some references that some of them are indirect.
Some are explicit. Some are indirect.
Hierocles was a student of Porphyry in the late 200s.
Well,
what you don't see in many of the Bible footnotes that are misleading is there are more than 40 utilizations of the contents of Mark 16:9-20 by writers who wrote before the year 486, while it was a Roman emperor on the throne of Rome.
40 church fathers before 486 have testimony to the full chapter of Mark 16.
Yes.
Wow. That's beautiful. Is there anything else about the church fathers that you'd like to add to what we've covered?
When you look at the usages in the third century work of De Baptist Mate, in the later work of Apostolic Constitutions, and the works of Augustine, Augustine quotes the entire passage. There's even a pagan writer, Hierocles, who's quoted by another writer named Macarius Magnes. Look at those writers and their range. Some of the ones that I mentioned are earlier than Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. Mm. So where those writers were, there was no question about it. And when it's used, for instance, like when it's used by Irenaeus, no question is raised about it. All those in a direct route to Rome, they seem to definitely accept the passage.
Right.
The range of attestation is one thing that's important to see, and oftentimes the visual evidence gets emphasized, but oftentimes when that's done, sometimes the also excellent support for Mark 16:9-20 gets overlooked. We have support from Patrick in Ireland, from a large number of supporters of the passage in Central Europe, and also in the East, even as far as Armenia. Esnik of Gold, one of the Armenian writers in the 400s, used Mark 16:17-18. So the passage is quoted in a very wide range, while the support for the ending at Mark 16:8 basically comes from Egypt. It's like the text was lost early on in Egypt, but meanwhile, everybody everywhere else was using it. Some scholars, especially Bruce Metzger and people echoing Metzger's handbook, would say that Clement of Alexandria never uses Mark 16:9-20. While that's true, Clement of Alexandria also uses hardly any text of Mark outside Mark chapter 10. So that's simply an argument from, not only an argument from silence, but it's an argument from a casual silence, a silence that you would not expect him to quote from those verses because he hardly quotes from any whole chapters of Mark.
Yeah, great point.
So if you want to say, well, he didn't quote from this part, well, yeah, but if that's true of Mark chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
right.
7,
yeah, right.
Why should he especially significant when he doesn't use his other proverbs?
Yes,
passage.
Great point. So now, if we could get to the Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, when we were at the Bodleian in Oxford, we pulled out their facsimile, and I'm wondering if you could explain to the audience what we saw when we looked at the actual page where the Gospel of Mark ends.
In that facsimile, and also online, you can also find Codex Vaticanus online and see the manuscript directly there. You'll see the text of Mark 16 concluding at the end of verse 8 in the second of three columns. The third column is entirely blank, and this is the only blank column throughout the whole New Testament in Vaticanus.
Because after that, then the Gospel of Luke begins, but this is a complete blank column, and they weren't writing on paper, right? This was vellum at that time. There were uncials. Yeah, so very expensive. They're not going to leave like a page or a column blank. So you have the third column is completely blank. And how about the second column when Mark ends?
There's three columns on the page. The second column is the one in which the text of Mark 16:8 ends. The rest of that column is blank. And then the third column is also blank. So what we have here is a case, what's called memorial space. This is not the only manuscript that does this. This is the only one that we see in Mark, but also in Codex L, another much later manuscript, there's blank space where you would expect to find the story of the woman caught in adultery. It's not there, but there's blank space. It's like the scribe is signaling to his reader, even though the passage was not in his exemplar, his master copy, he recalled in another source there was something there. And that also happens in Codex Delta regarding the story of the woman caught in adultery. But I have reconstructed the text of Mark 16:19-20 just as an experiment to see, was this space memorial space? Was it that kind of phenomenon? And you can fit the text of Mark 16:19-20 if you start immediately where Mark 16:8 ends, work your way down to the last line of the last column. If you write the scribe's normal way, there's not quite enough room. The scribes knew how to compress their lettering.
Right.
You can see scribes compress the lettering, by the way, on the cancel sheet, the replacement pages of Codex Sinaiticus. They compress it there much more drastically than you would need to fit the text onto the page.
It's just like when we're handwriting. It's just like when we're handwriting in the memo of a check and we realize there's not enough room and we just fit it.
Well, you can do that line by line. And we see the scribe of Codex Sinaiticus do that in his replacement pages there at the beginning of Luke. The lettering is compacted much more drastically than you would need to compress it to fit the text into that blank space on Codex Vaticanus. In fact, I have online, I've put it in several forms, a picture, a reconstruction.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Of the text of Mark 16:19-20 in that blank space using the scribe's own lettering, those letters that you see on my reconstruction, and that they can really do this perfectly over the radio.
Right.
But using the scribe's own lettering from elsewhere on the same page, I've digitally cut and pasted the whole text of Mark 16:19-20 onto that page using the scribe's own handwriting.
Yes.
You can see that it fits very well.
It's brilliant. In fact, James White, in a debate on this, he said, it's on YouTube, he said the text wouldn't really fit there. And I'm thinking, has he seen James Snap Jr.'s reproduction? Because it's just beautiful. Thank you for doing that work. So you're saying that even Vaticanus, which is one of the two big claims why we shouldn't have the full chapter 16 of Mark, even Vaticanus leaves a space for it. Are there spaces like that elsewhere in the New Testament, in Vaticanus?
In the Codex Vaticanus, no, there are no other blank columns at all.
So this would be
no text in the column at all.
So this would be very unusual, and it's suggesting that the scribe who's writing Vaticanus, he's telling us something by leaving that space.
Now, yes, that's what memorial space does. It's a signal from the scribe,
yes,
to say the passage that you're not seeing is not in my exemplar, so I didn't preserve it because I was following my exemplar, but I recall it from another source.
Now, we've talked about the great number of manuscripts of Mark. Could you remind me again the number that you say do not have the full chapter? What actual number is missing that full chapter?
Contrary to the impression that you might get from some Bible footnotes, I don't know why they always say some, because most people can count to three. It's three.
It's three, and the one you said was actually a commentary.
One is a medieval commentary with a mostly Byzantine text, yes.
Okay. And right here, we have the scribe in Vaticanus leaving a memorial space telling us there's something going on here. How about Sinaiticus? How do you pronounce Codex Sinaiticus?
It's supposed to be pronounced Codex Sinaiticus, but often we garble that one extra syllable.
Yes.
But Codex Vaticanus has the memorial space. Now, memorial space didn't have to be exact. It just had to be an approximation to signal, I remember there was something else here from another source. It didn't have to be exact. Same way in Codex L and Codex Delta. It doesn't have to be exact to say, oh, that's what it's for.
Is there anything else about the second of these two most famous manuscripts used as the argument for shortening Mark 16?
There is one point that I think Dan Wallace has brought up, that there are blank spaces earlier in Vaticanus in the Old Testament portion. Apparently in his chapter in the book Perspectives on the Ending of Mark, he just has trouble trying to figure out why are these blanks there, but it's really easy to figure out. Those are incidental blank spaces because of different factors involved in the production of the manuscript. For instance, when the script format changes at the beginning of the poetic books from three columns per page to two columns per page, obviously there's going to be a break there. They're easy to figure out why they're there because of quirks that came about in the production of the manuscript. That's not a hard question. But regarding Sinaiticus now, Sinaiticus has a very unique feature at the end of Mark and the beginning of Luke. if you could picture those four pages of the text written on one sheet of parchment, folded in the middle to kind of look like a church bulletin. Those four pages were not written by the same copyist that wrote the pages that come before and after. Those pages are a cancel sheet. This is not the only cancel sheet, but it's the only one that pertains to the ending of Mark. In Codex Sinaiticus, after the main copyist had written his text of that last part of Mark and the first part of Luke, the proofreader enters the picture. And the proofreader said, there's something wrong here. There was some kind of mistake that was so bad that the proofreader or the supervisor at the monastery, or scriptorium, I should say, of the scriptorium, said, these pages have to be redone. So we don't have the pages of Mark 16 and most of Luke chapter 1 made by the main copyist of Codex Sinaiticus. The pages that are in the manuscript now were written by the supervisor of the scriptorium, the Diathotis. It's his writing that we see on those pages. And on those pages, we see him begin with Mark and end it at Mark 16, verse 8. There's a very emphatic coronis or arabesque design at the end of Mark, much more emphatic than he usually made it. But also, when you look at his text of Luke, in Luke, he compressed his lettering to an almost ridiculous degree, while as he was writing in Mark, he stretches out his lettering to make sure that it does not come to the end of the column before reaching the end of verse 8. If he had written it normally, he would have come to the end of verse 8 before reaching the end of the column. Mm-hmm. He did not want to leave a blank column there. And you can look at that page and you can see how this works. The text is usually written about 630 letters per column. In that column, though, there's only about 550 letters.
Wow.
The only reason to stretch out his lettering was because he was aware that there was a question about how the text should be formatted at this point. So even though in Sinaiticus 2, you have the ending of Mark at verse 8, you also have an indication of the scribe's awareness that there's some kind of controversy about leaving a blank column here.
Hmm.
Those are the extant copies of Mark from ancient times that end the text at verse 8. All the others, Codex Alexandrinus ends with 9 to 20. Codex D is damaged, but includes up to verse 15, which implies that when the copy was pristine, it included the whole text. You have Codex C, which is a palimpsest, a recycled manuscript, but you can look through the upper writing and see the lower writing, and there is Mark all the way up to verses 14 through 16 on one page. Codex W has the Philologion, but that's not a separate ending. That is embedded between verse 14 and verse 15, and the text continues all the way to verse 20. You could just go down a list of the Family One manuscripts that have a note in them that says, in some copies, the text is ended here, and this is where Eusebius ended his canons. But then it says, and I don't think Metzger really emphasizes this, and a lot of people that depend on Metzger never realize it, but the note then says that in many, this also appears. And in manuscripts 20 and 300, and there's another one, they say the same thing, but instead of saying in many, this also appears, they'll say, but in the ancient ones, this is all there. And it continues with verses 9 through 20.
Wow. It's been described as an organic consensus developed so that from the time of the writing of Mark until about the year 300, when Eusebius brings up the issue, you don't find the early church wrestling over the ending. And then, centered in Egypt, like you said, there was an issue for a couple hundred years that seemed to then have been resolved organically. So like there was a difficulty that arose in Egypt, and it was an issue for a couple hundred years, and it seemed to have gotten resolved in favor of the full chapter of Mark 16.
Yes, there are manuscripts of lectionaries which contain the readings that were used in the church services from Egypt, and they contain Mark 16, 9 through 20. In fact, there's a special series of the Heothena readings, or Heothenon, which include Mark 16, 9 through 20.
Wow. James, what a wonderful overview of this part of your life's work. Thank you for putting in the effort to be a New Testament textual critic who has rescued the full gospel of Mark. And thank you for writing your great book that we will link to from our website, rsr.org. your book, Authentic, The Case for Mark 16, 9 through 20.
There's more details about this that I give in my video series free on YouTube. Lectures 16 and 17 are just about this topic.
And we will link to those. In fact, I'd like to embed that first video 16 on the show summary at rsr.org. James Knapp, thank you so very much.
Thank you. If I explained anything in an unclear manner, it should be sorted out in the book, which is only 99 cents. So if anybody has any questions, it should be easy to find the answers there.
Yeah, it's a great Kindle book. May God bless you, James. Thank you. This is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Talking about.